You're listening to a Times Higher Education podcast.
The JISC Digital Festival, known as DigiFest and staged by the Education Technology Consortium JISC, was held in Birmingham on the 9th and 10th March 2015. My name's Chris Parr, I'm a reporter at THE. I was there and was lucky enough to speak with two of the keynote speakers, Richard Watson, author of the best-selling book Future Files, A Brief History of the Next 50 Years, who we'll hear from a little bit later, and first to the University of Manchester's Carol Goebel. Hello, I'm joined at the JISC DigiFest by Carol Goebel, a professor in the School of Computer Science at the University of Manchester. She's just off the stage where she's giving a keynote this morning. Carol, one of the things you spoke about was that research, the way it's produced at the moment, PDF file, buried on the internet, is currently sort of unfindable, I think was the phrase you used. And then you said when you do find it, often you can't trust it because some of the methods used aren't certainly not transparent. And if they were transparent, maybe we'd be questioning them quite seriously as to the results they've produced. It sort of undermines academia and research in general, doesn't it?
Well, there is this kind of tenet of research that it should be reproducible. And this turns out to be quite difficult. And reproducibility is itself a sophisticated and complex object to discuss. So in my talk, I raised the issue about reproducibility versus replication. Replication is when you really want to be able to exactly replicate an experiment that somebody has published in order to be able to see if it's true, the trust. So you build trust, you certify its outcomes. Whereas reproducing is, I want to do some variation on that and see if I'll get a similar result. So I'm applying my own data set, so I'm changing my own methodology and seeing if the results are similar. So it's a kind of sophisticated landscape that gets all kind of piled into the term of unreproducible research. But the fundamental thing is transparency and being very clear about how you reported not just the data that you used, the materials that you used, but the method that you used. And that method could be an experimental method, a statistical method, or a computational method, and often these days, all three.
And you pointed in your talk to some of the reasons where research goes wrong.
Yes.
Some of the reasons you can't fight. You said you're not going to make a second Large Hadron Collider to sort of, you know, make sure its results are accurate. But a few of the things you mentioned seem to speak to sort of the culture of academia in a way. You had a picture of a disorganized desk, which you described as a typical scientist desk. You said people were developing resources, software for subject-specific use rather than things that can be used more widely. This thing we mentioned before about outdated publication methods. You said RIP, rest in publication. Yeah. You know, we've done it this way for ages. We'll continue to do it like this, even though it means it all gets lost. Is there a bit of a culture shift needed in the way that universities go about research?
Yeah, there is a culture shift. I mean, it's an activation energy issue. There gets to a point where you really cannot continue to go on the way you are. And there's also a culture of training the next generation as well. So I was talking to a new collaborator I'm working with, and we asked him, where's your data going to be stored? Because I'm responsible for his data. In this new project. And, okay, well, it's going to be stored on a disk under his desk.
Right.
And how are you going to make it available to other people? Well, it's going to be an image in a paper.
Right.
Well, and I said, you really can't do that these days. And I'm glad to say that the rest of the meeting, including senior researchers and professors, went, you can't do that. So there's a kind of change of emphasis that says, well, it isn't any more acceptable to just produce the paper. You have to produce the supplementary materials. And then the supplementary materials have to become more active than just the Excel files that you use as the result of your analytics. You have to also include all the other methodologies that you used, including the software. So I think there is a bit of a change. The trouble is, it takes time, it takes expertise, it takes training, it takes infrastructure, and it takes recognition by the institutions, by the communities themselves, by the research labs. So that's hard work.
Sure.
Because I've also worked with young researchers who want to curate their data, want to curate their software, want to spend time on doing it, and their professors have said, well, what are you doing wasting your time doing that? You could be writing a paper. So there's some education to be done. We have to re-educate quite a lot.
Finally, I wanted to ask you about one thing you mentioned, which was academic trolling. And you said it was worse than internet trolling, which, of course, everyone is aware of, given the coverage those incidents kind of get. And I think you gave one small example. I think was it a paper that you'd written where someone read it and said, oh, you've written it in a style that means the people it's aimed at will be able to understand it. Oh, and instead of going for what I think you called the most complicated method and the most complicated approach in order to make sure a paper is referable, could be sent to the research excellence framework. I was wondering if you had any more examples or why that's a problem and where it's manifesting.
So academic trolling, really there were two classes there that I mentioned. The first class is trolled because you made something straightforward, because you wanted a community to understand it, when your job was to make it look clever. And I'm a computer scientist, so who happens to also do a lot of work in applied computer science. So I do applied computer science, building resources so other scientists can do their work. And so for me, I was interested in promoting that to those communities. I've written papers in those communities, and they get massively cited, really like high numbers of citations, much more than in computer science. And I could have presented a paper about the detailed denotational semantics of the lambda calculus used underneath the workflow engine. Or I could have just said, here's a workflow engine. This is how to use it. And of course, that kind of useful and highly cited paper is merely useful as opposed to academic. And there's a bit of snobbery around that to do with... It's not so much snobbery. There's some concerns about that to do with whether it's
grand enough?
Rigorous enough.
Okay, so whether it's
quality for the particular discipline. Now, of course, there's equal on both sides. You want to be able to report both, but you shouldn't diss one in front of the other. You know, oh, that's just theory, therefore completely irrelevant. Or that's just practice, therefore merely workmanlike artisan research.
Yeah.
As if artisan research is something to be spat upon. Because I'm an artisan researcher, actually. But artisans are what made science great. You don't think that Hooke went and made his own bloody lens, do you? There's artisans in science, and people who build software are the new artisans of science. They're the new lens makers. We're the new microscope makers. And the other kind of trolling is the trolling where you do a replication study, or you say something that is quite heretical or controversial, or particularly in this case, I was thinking of replication studies where you replicate a finding. It doesn't turn out the way it should do. You attempt to publish it. Nobody wants to know. Either because who wants to have a replication? Where would you publish a replication study? And also, if you're going against a kind of mainstream, people can be quite nasty. Peer review can be very unpleasant. Public peer review can be really unpleasant if people decide that you're kind of, on a different path. And that is, I've never personally had that, or if I have, I've been so thick-skinned I haven't noticed, which is quite likely, actually.
So public, you mean sort of comments or
comments,
an email online and
Twitter stuff. Yeah. One of my colleagues who's a biologist said people can be very unkind, and that is the case, particularly in very competitive discovery fields. So I'm an engineer. So engineers, we decide on some algorithm, we decide on some software, we decide on some architecture, and then I publish a paper on it, and then you come up with your own idea and you publish a paper on it, and then we compare. We both publish a paper on it, and then we integrate and we both publish a paper on it. It's like a kind of collaborative kind of research pyramid, if you will. Whereas in biology, I'm looking at the function of a gene, you're looking at the function of the gene, the first person to publish wins.
Yeah.
It's very competitive. You're not going to get a paper to be the second person who discovered the function of this gene. And that's part of the competitiveness of that field, kind of leads to this very almost defensive, quite competitive publishing world.
Carol, thank you very much for speaking to me.
Okay.
You're listening to a Times Higher Education podcast.
So I'm with Richard Watson, author, advisor to IBM, DfE and more, Department for Education, that is, I should say. In your presentation, you mentioned that in 10 to 15 years, everyone will have an avatar assistant, or could have, much like Siri, that a lot of people will be familiar with. It'll be smarter than they are because it's connected to the internet. I mean, it rather begs the question, what does that mean for universities' role, particularly their role imparting knowledge on people? Because if they can just ask their phones, why do they need to get the facts and the data from an expensive university course?
First of all, I think we've got to be a bit careful. I think, you know, the use of the word will is that's 100% certain. So, I mean, to some extent, it's said to be provocative. You know, we have that to some extent right now. And I'm not suggesting that really seriously that every single person will have it, but I think an increasing number of people will have these kinds of things. And we're already beginning to see customer service avatars, for example. I think the reason that we will still have physical schools, universities, colleges is, you know, the same reason we've still got libraries to some extent, because it's not just about the information. Mm. With early years education, it's a lot to do with socialization. As you get sort of higher up the levels of the game, so to speak, you still have that social element, but it's also to do with serendipity. And it's I mean, for example, if you sort of switch to libraries, it's not just about the books, it's about what goes on in a very special space. Mm. It's not just any old space, and it's to do with the interaction of people, ideas and events, and it's people talking to other deliberately, accidentally, and yes, you know, online learning is here, it's going to expand, etc., etc., and in some instances you might prefer to do that rather than the school or university. I mean, if you're in the middle of Africa, it would make sense to do everything online. But I think in most other instances, there is value in the space, but also value in the people. And it's very difficult to replicate an inspiring teacher. Yes, if you've got a really boring lecturer just spouting out dull facts and then buggering off, why would you bother showing up for that? You might as well go onto YouTube. But if you've actually got somebody that actually sort of brings some real verve to it, that is actually entertaining and informative and grabs people emotionally, you know, that's very difficult to code for, so to speak.
But you expressed a concern that Generation Y, as you phrased it, doesn't like that personal interaction. It doesn't want to be face-to-face with people.
Yeah.
Many of them are almost intimidated by the prospect of that. So at the minute they have to hand over $9,000 a year to go along and learn in person, where, you know, if they just sit at home Googling it, they can get all the
data. Hopefully what will happen, I mean, first of all, you've got to bear in mind that it's incredibly early days. Most of these technologies we're talking about aren't very old, and we haven't quite worked out how to use them properly. They're obviously going to develop very significantly. What I think will happen is that it'll sort of shake the market out a bit, and indifferent universities will cease to exist, or they will go entirely online, a bit like with some publications, possibly for free. And the ones that survive are clearly going to have some major value add. I mean, if you're paying 9,000 versus nothing, there's got to be something going on there. But I don't foresee a situation where physical universities disappear altogether in a million years.
Sure. You mentioned, you know, more and more jobs are becoming more and more at risk from the development of robots. You cited in car development, you know, online resources, lawyers, you said, are at risk because Google now scans so much case law. What they need is, you said, personality to survive. They need to be good with people. Surgeons, you said, are at risk because we're getting machines that can do it. But if they've got a good bedside manner, to paraphrase what you were saying, if they're good with people, their jobs are safe as well. Is this true as well of educators, do you think? If you're just giving the facts to the students, then you're essentially
If you're not very good at your job, and your job can be done by a computer. I mean, if you are essentially doing something that's very rule-based, and you're not very good at it, I would train for something else quite soon, quite frankly. The one thing I would say about the statement, and you know, they're not my statements, they're other people's statements, is that there will be a reaction to this. I mean, if it seriously looks like smart machines, expert systems, algorithms are going to start stealing people's jobs, the government isn't going to sit there and let that happen. there will be a reaction to that. There'll be a regulatory reaction, there'll be a social reaction, it could be unions get involved, not that they're especially strong anymore. So it's the great mistake, I think, of technologists and people is to assume some sort of linear extrapolation, and there will be a reaction to that. But nevertheless, it does look like the shift is towards more jobs being automated. And that would focus attention on jobs that are in one way or another creative or empathetic. I mean, management is something that's very difficult to automate, because management is very emotionally based. It's quite intuitive a lot of the time. And yes, you can have all kinds of data around stuff, but it still ultimately is to do with trying to inspire or tell off individuals, which machines aren't very good at.
Finally, I promise this is the final one. There was some sort of irony about the last speech at the GIST Digital Festival being almost a lecture on why we should all turn off our digital devices. I think you said at least once, one day a week, although the feel of the speech was very much that it should be more. I guess my question, to keep it relevant to our readers in education settings, is, do you think that people feel under pressure to use technology? And you said in their personal life they often perhaps do, but maybe lecturers, for example, feel a pressure to use technology in
Absolutely.
The classroom, even
Absolutely.
Though it's perhaps not always the best way.
Absolutely, and I think this boils down to people aren't thinking deeply about this stuff. And I also really object to this sort of binary thing of, you know, all blackboards or whiteboards, whatever the latest version is, are bad, we're going to throw them out and we're going to get this new stuff. And actually, well, hang on a minute, this stuff is good at certain things, this new stuff seems to be good at certain things. We'll combine the two, we'll work out what we're trying to do, and we'll get hold of the correct technology, if you like. And I suppose that, you know, yes, it was a sort of, to some extent, it wasn't a Luddite speech, but it was talking about common sense and balance, I suppose, were the sort of key words there. And I'm really just talking from personal experience and an increasing knowledge of, you know, how we think and how we have ideas and all the rest of it. And it seems that I'm not alone. I think we're beginning to see a lot of people moving in that direction. I mean, there's a magazine called Delayed Gratification, which is the absolute opposite of fast-paced media. We're seeing a lot of rebalancing. And again, I'm not suggesting for a second we switch all this stuff off and become sort of neo-Luddites. I'm just saying a degree of common sense. And, you know, at the end of the day, we are human beings and we seem to enjoy interacting physically, and we should continue to do that. And I am concerned about some of the sort of blind acceptance of these technologies. But as you say, it's a bit of a strange one to do, but I thought it would be good to do something a little bit more provocative.
Richard Watson, thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
You're listening to a Times Higher Education podcast.